Our top story this week, bigger problems in Miami. Infections are being reported in most areas of the city as the four original neighborhoods to report infection transition to the second stage, or reanimation of the infected. As a defensive perimeter is established around Miami-Dade County, Miami Mayor Santiago Vasquez gives an impassioned plea to the federal government to deploy forces from Fort Benning to come to the city's defense. Our war correspondent Kate Malik is in Miami and will report on the situation there. In California, a survivor from a living stronghold in San Francisco is reunited with family members in the new state capital of Redding after escaping the dead city and its army of infected. Family members had given up hope of her survival after the city's fall, but a spirit of courage and determination prevailed, allowing her to successfully navigate her way to safety in a harrowing tale of ingenuity and endurance. She'll tell us how she escaped and what it's like being trapped behind the lines in a city controlled by the reanimated. A delegation from the European Union arrived this week to meet with President Stevenson and discuss greater coordination of research efforts and open the door to greater economic relief from the United States. Proponents of greater aid argue that the United States has a moral responsibility to increase relief efforts. While many here worry that the federal government needs to focus on stabilizing the situation at home first, our Washington correspondent will report on the summit. The Harvard-Yale boat races are scheduled to take place this week, marking the first time since the pandemic outbreak that a major sporting event has been organized. Coordinators of the event along the Thames River in Connecticut are using it as an opportunity to bring local communities together to raise money and resources for more heavily impacted parts of the country. We'll take you to New London and introduce you to organizers, competitors, and spectators. And at this week's RLA discussion table, I'll be joined by three of the Washington Beltway's most prominent thought leaders. Join us as we discuss the current state of the Stevenson presidency. We'll address his handling of the pandemic and what his impact has been on the state of American politics. You're listening to Radio Living America, and I'm your host, Brian Andrews. We begin this segment with disturbing reports of infections getting out of control in Miami, Florida. What began in four of the city's most densely populated areas has now spread countywide, with infections being reported in every district, as well as reports of reanimation in those areas first affected. Our war correspondent Kate Malik arrived in Miami today and brings us the latest.
Brian, I'm here at Miami Beach Golf Club, which is serving as an impromptu headquarters for Mayor Santiago Vasquez and his staff as infection rages across Miami neighborhoods located on mainland Florida. We departed New Orleans early yesterday aboard a military transport that was bringing SEAL Team 8 to Miami following the conclusion of Operation Southern Lights. But our flight was diverted to Fort Lauderdale after it was determined that the area around Miami International Airport had become too dangerous. As it stands right now, every section of the city is reporting wildfire infection, with the exception of the barrier island that makes up Miami Beach and its resort community, which so far has remained orderly. Mayor Vasquez held a press conference earlier today.
Our early attempts at containment have failed, in as much as every neighborhood in Miami-Dade County is reporting infection, and many are reporting reanimation. Our local defense forces have established defensive strongholds across the city, and we are highly encouraging healthy citizens to go to the strongholds nearest your neighborhood and wait for further instruction. These strongholds include, but are not limited to, the Miami Zoo, the Miami International Airport, and the Jackson Memorial Hospital Complex. Unless traveling to a defensive stronghold, we ask that people stay off the streets as much as possible to allow freedom of movement for our defense forces. I have also personally ordered the establishment of a defensive front in mainland Miami along the water from Museum Park, south to the Intercontinental Hotel, and extending west to I-5. I'll take any questions. Yes, over here.
Mayor Vasquez, has there been any update on the assault force at Fort Benning and when, or even if, they'll be coming to Miami to participate in securing the city?
The governor and myself have informed the president that our National Guard and our local defense forces have been stretched to capacity, and we have requested national military assets to contain the crisis. It is our understanding that those assets are being mobilized as we speak.
Mr. Mayor, is your establishment of these defensive centers an admission that you are losing control of the city? It seems that you are preparing the citizens of Miami to be isolated in a dead city.
Absolutely not. We have been preparing for this crisis since the earliest days of the pandemic. I spent 14 years in the Marine Corps, stationed in the Middle East and East Africa, and I've defended more tenuous positions than this. The establishment of defensive strongholds creates better freedom of movement for our local guard while giving us a centralized location to administer vital services while we prepare for the arrival of the Army's task force. If Miami becomes a dead city, it's going to have to be over my reanimated body.
Now, Brian, that press conference was 4 hours ago. And even since then, word has come out of the city that local defense forces are pulling back closer and closer to their assigned strongholds as the situation in Miami continues to deteriorate. With a population measured at over 2.5 million people, a loss of Miami-Dade County wouldn't just mean the loss of strategic seaports, it would also represent one of the largest dead cities in the country and a huge humanitarian tragedy. Reporting from the front in Miami Beach, Florida, I'm Kate Malik.
Kate Malik, thank you. We take you now to a story of survival as a woman is reunited with her family after escaping San Francisco. From Redding, California, Laura Sanders has more.
It was a tearful moment when Jennifer Middleton was reunited with her family here.
Oh my God! I don't believe it!
Jennifer, a 25-year-old public relations specialist, had sought shelter at her office on the 38th floor of the North American Bank Tower when San Francisco was declared a dead city 10 months ago. She shared her story with us today.
It was like the military was still there 1 second and gone the next. There were about 200 of us in the North American Banking Tower between all the different floors. It wasn't too bad at first. There weren't too many infected in the building, and we were able to go up and down the stairwells and smash open vending machines and raid the kitchens in different offices. We'd go to the roof to collect rainwater, and we expected that some kind of rescue force would come and get us. By the beginning of the summer, we were running out of everything, and a group of us made the decision to try and go for it.
How many were in your party when you left the building?
There were 14 of us. We left in the middle of the night in a freak thunderstorm. It was really dark, and the rain and the lightning seemed to confuse them. Our plan was to get across the Golden Gate Bridge into Marin County.
Jeff, you gotta pull your fucking shit together. That last swarm almost hurt us.
If that lightning strike hadn't been so close, they definitely would have hurt us.
I'll try.
You're going to need to do a lot more than try.
We're at the Palace of Fine Arts. Chrissy Field is just down the street. We need to keep moving.
Okay, everybody. It's starting to get light out. We need to move as fast as we can. Once we get to Chrissy Field, we'll sprint up the beach to the bridge, okay? On three. 1, 2, 3. Let's go. Oh, no.
It's gone.
No.
The bridge is gone.
They must have blown the bridge.
Oh, God. What are we going to do? Everybody run for it.
Our Father who art in heaven. When we got to the bay at Chrissy Field around dawn, we could see the Golden Gate Bridge had been blown. That's when we were overwhelmed by a big group of them. I ran down to the water, and there was an old mattress on the beach. I dragged it into the water and paddled out into the bay where I was sucked out into the ocean.
Jennifer spent 2 days on her makeshift raft, ultimately washing up on the beach at the Fort Ross State Park, some 75 miles north of San Francisco on the rural Sonoma coast, where she was found by a group of fishermen. As far as she knows, there's still over 150 people trapped in the North American Banking Tower, Their fate is unknown, but suffering is easy to imagine.
When I left the building, there was almost nothing left. They were probably able to collect a good amount of water in the storm we left in, but there wasn't any food left. I don't want to think about what it's like in that building right now.
It's unknown how many people are still holding on in San Francisco. The city had a pre-pandemic population of about 800,000, and observers say it's feasible for as much as 0.5% of a city's population to survive in a city in living strongholds, which would put the number still trapped in San Francisco possibly as high as 4,000. But with the traditionally dry summer season upon us and no access to water, survivors are going to be faced with the terrifying decision to plan escape or remain in an impossible situation. Back to you, Brian.
Following the break, we'll take you to Washington and bring you the latest on the president's meeting with the EU delegation and what it could mean for greater coordination with the international community to address the pandemic.
The world is a scary, difficult place these days, but that doesn't mean we place a lesser value on our children's education. I'm Jason Scully, and as founder of Doctrina Educational Systems Incorporated, I've dedicated my career to developing high-quality, homeschool programs that rival any public school system and most private schools. Do you worry about sending your child to a school where they could be exposed to the pandemic? Do you live in an area where gasoline restrictions have made access to a proper school too difficult for your child? Have you just felt that you could do a better job educating your child on your own? If you answered yes to any of these questions, you should consider Doctrina Educational Systems Incorporated. But don't just take my word for it. Listen to what parents had to say about our program.
We put Jessica in the Doctrina program starting in the 8th grade. She did great, and we had a lot of fun having her at home. If Ellie hadn't fallen, she would have started her freshman year at UCLA last fall. But now she's at the Air Force Academy in Colorado and doing great. Thanks, Doctrina.
Contact a Doctrina representative and see if there's a program that fits your needs. And don't forget, sign up 3 families and get a free semester from Doctrina. Stop aggravating yourself with the challenges of education in the pandemic age and contact a Doctrina representative today.
Welcome back. President Stevenson is hosting a delegation from the EU this week. Casting the summit in a hopeful light, the president says the meeting will lead to a greater exchange of ideas on how to best combat the crisis, as well as create a stronger environment of cooperation between scientific communities. But the meeting was not without controversy, as the president signaled he was open to providing greater economic and military assistance to the European Union. RLA's Chuck Fleming is in Washington with more.
The European delegation arrived earlier this week in Baltimore, Maryland, aboard the Belgian frigate Louise Marie, and proceeded directly to Washington to meet with the president here at the White House. The diplomatic mission was described by the administration as a meeting intended to improve lines of communication on research regarding the pandemic. But at a press conference with EU Minister Philippe Marchand, President Stevenson quickly opened up to the possibilities of more material assistance to the European Union, signaling greater economic and military aid from the United States could be on its way.
Minister Marchand and I have had a very productive couple of days. I think the scientists of our two countries are going to be working diligently together, very diligently together, to get to a place of greater understanding, greater knowledge around this disease. A strong partnership between the US and the EU doesn't just benefit our two parties, it benefits the world. As such, it may be necessary for the United States to increase aid to the European Union beyond the agricultural aid we've provided thus far in the crisis.
Any foreign aid that involved anything beyond agricultural products would be a first since the pandemic began, and the president remained vague when pressed by reporters.
Look, we aren't alone in this fight, and I think we need to keep everything on the table. Some places in Europe are faring very badly in this crisis, and I don't want to take anything off the table.
Mr. President, would you consider sending refined petroleum products to the European Union?
Nothing is off the table. I just told you, it benefits the world to have the pandemic contained in Europe, and we need to do what we can.
Mr. President, would you consider deploying American military assets to Europe?
Nothing is off the table.
The president quickly drew fire for his remarks from both sides of the aisle, with Majority Leader Gus McDermott saying this on the Senate floor.
There isn't a member of this chamber that doesn't want to provide assistance to our European allies. But the president's gambling with this country's future at a time when we can't even provide assistance to many of our own citizens. It's insane. With a Galveston operation barely completed, at an enormous cost, I might add, that the president is even thinking of sending refined petroleum products outside the U.S. We don't even have the fuel reserves to send helicopters into living strongholds to rescue survivors, much less the military assets to retake a dead city. And the president wants to open a discussion on sending these kind of resources overseas at a time when every major city on the West Coast is no longer under government control. Denver is constantly under contamination threat. Miami is teetering on the brink of the abyss, and the largest city in Texas has just been completely destroyed in a bombing campaign undertaken by the United States Air Force. The president should put the needs of the American people first and worry less about pleasing the governments of other countries. I stand committed and ask for the commitment of my colleagues to block any attempt by this president to send anything other than surplus agricultural products anywhere outside the United States.
The White House later released a statement reminding Americans that no actual deal had been reached and negotiations would be ongoing. This all comes as latest polling indicates America's confidence in the president and his ability to lead the country through this crisis continues to drop. However, increased aid to the European Union is not without its proponents. Earlier today, Dr. Krishna Singh of the Centers for Disease Control had this to say.
Two of our greatest partners in research are at the French National Institute of Health in Paris and the Robert Koch Institute in Berlin. The CDC doesn't weigh in on matters of public policy that do not concern the public's health, but if operational effectiveness of either of these institutes was jeopardized, it would be a major setback in our fight against the crisis.
Reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Chuck Fleming. Back to you, Brian.
The nation will get a welcome moment of respite from the pandemic this weekend as the Harvard-Yale boat races mark the first major collegiate sporting event to take place since the pandemic outbreak. Teams began assembling this week for an event that has seldom been missed since 1852. For more on the story, we take you to Miles Duggan in New London, Connecticut.
The regatta is still days away, but that didn't stop Harvard from drawing first blood in this storied rivalry, announcing this morning that in a covert nighttime operation, their men's varsity heavyweight team had managed to kidnap Gorgeous George, the British bulldog that serves as Yale's beloved mascot. You could hear Crimson Faithful singing from miles away. But one only had to be here moments before they heard the Yale Bulldogs making their presence known. While the rivalry was apparent on the surface, a strong collegiate spirit of unity could be felt everywhere as the two-day event is being hosted as an opportunity to expose attendees to pandemic charities, raise awareness for upcoming pandemic war bond offerings, and drive recruitment for everything from local defense forces to state National Guard to National Military Service. In an interview today with KGAG4 New London, Pete Schilling, president of Harvard University, said this.
I think the students and faculty of both universities recognize how fortunate we are to live in an area of the country that has been so minimally impacted by the pandemic. I had breakfast this morning with Yale President Wim Witter, and both of us are bursting with enthusiasm to be part of this historic event.
Now, Brian, historically, the boat race was the main draw for this event, which is open to the public. But this year, organizers, recognizing that there is little opportunity for community celebration, have more closely coordinated with local government to broaden the entertainment appeal of the event. I was lucky enough to catch up with New London Mayor Barbara Ketchum today. Mayor Ketchum, Miles Duggan, Radio Living America. Tell us how this year's event is different from previous boat races.
It's about so much more than the boat races this year. I mean, the Harvard-Yale rivalry is still the main event, but we've got top musical talent donating their time. All the local restaurants and taverns will be present servicing the event, and we're going to have some great demonstrations on safety and best practices by the Connecticut National Guard. I think it's going to be a really great time, and everybody in city government is excited about it. We're expecting a big crowd, so the governor has authorized me to offer special ration credits and a special event tax amnesty to any new London resident who opens their home to a visitor in town for the races.
Brian, people who are more local to this event have been arriving all week. But with the governors of Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey all granting special petroleum allowances to mass transit companies involved in bringing people to New London for the races, city planners are preparing for a crowd that could measure as big as 500,000. Reporting enthusiastically from New London, Connecticut, I'm Miles Duggan.
Miles Duggan, thank you. And we will keep Gorgeous George in our thoughts and prayers. When we return, we'll be joined by our panel at the RLA discussion table.
Hey, Brad. It's been a while. How's things?
Oh, hey, Pete. Things are good. Just trying to get some errands done.
You know what? Wendy and I are taking the kids up to the lake this weekend. Why don't you guys join us?
Oh, man. I'd love to, but I haven't been issued gasoline credits in over 7 months. And the lake is just too far for the kids to walk.
Gasoline credits? Why don't you get a Ventana electric bike?
A what?
A Ventana electric bike. Their Roadrunner 4000 has seating for 2 adults and 2 children, and twin saddlebags in case you need to grab a few things and bug out. And with their new 1,000 watt-hour per kilogram solid-state battery, you have an improved range of 400 miles and a burst speed to 55 miles per hour. You shouldn't let a lack of gasoline stop you and Jane from going out and doing things with the kids.
I had no idea. You know what, Pete? You just might be seeing us this weekend at the lake.
Welcome back to the RLA discussion table. I'm joined today by Godfrey Pembroke, editor-in-chief of the Washington Spectator, Wendy Albrecht, chief political correspondent for the New York Herald, and Simon Grassley, Washington correspondent for the London Examiner. Thanks to you all for being here. Godfrey, I'd like to begin with you. What do you make of this presidency, and what kind of legacy do you think President Stevenson is creating for himself?
Well, I think James Buchanan must be looking down with great relief.
Oh, come now, sir. Do you really think that's fair?
I think it's entirely fair.
For our listeners who are unaware, James Buchanan was the nation's 15th president, immediately preceding Abraham Lincoln. His inaction on the issue of slavery is widely believed to have positioned the country for civil war, and he is generally accepted by historians to be America's worst president.
I think the comparison has enormous merit. Both men seem to be out of step with the problems of their time. Both men try to prioritize the unimportant in an attempt to avoid the pressing issues of the day. And I believe that when his presidency is over, President Stevenson, like President Buchanan, will spend the rest of his life trying to justify why his failures were everyone's fault but his own.
Wendy, let's go to you. Do you think Godfrey is making a fair assessment?
Yes and no. I mean, look, this crisis is not of President Stevenson's creation. Was there a failure to act early on? Maybe. But I think assertions made by people like Governor Chan of California that the president failed to act out of a sense of ambivalence is unfair. You have to remember, when Stevenson ran for president, he did it on a platform of being the steady candidate, the safe choice with a strong track record of a member of the Washington establishment. The nation knew it wasn't electing a warrior, and I think now circumstances have overwhelmed him.
If I could jump in. There is one thing this president has done exceptionally well, and that's to unify the legislative branches of the United States government. Just look at the reaction on the Senate floor today. In all my years reporting on American politics, I don't ever remember a time when the Senate was so passionate and unanimous in their thinking. Well, you see those kind of outbursts routinely in the British Parliament, but I don't ever remember seeing it here.
I don't ever remember seeing anything like that in my career either. Godfrey, What's your take on what we saw today?
Well, I'm quite torn on it, really. On the one hand, I find it as encouraging as it is entertaining to actually see members of the upper chamber so passionate about something other than their own careers for once. On the other hand, one doesn't expect this departure from civility in the United States Senate. What's next? Are they going to start beating each other with canes? One thing is certain, though. These kinds of fiery speeches, like the one from Majority Leader McDermott, fueled by a jeering Senate gallery, will make it much harder for President Stevenson to regain the public's confidence.
Wendy, do you think it's already over for this president? We have an election next year. Has the public's faith in President Stevenson been permanently lost?
No, of course not. In a few months, we should see gasoline restrictions easing as a byproduct of the Galveston operation. And let's see what happens with the situation in Miami. It appears he's on the cusp of ordering a major military force to southern Florida to assist in saving the city. And if he can pull off a successful operation there, I think it would go a long way to reestablishing the public's trust.
Well, that's a big if, Wendy. This kind of decisive action doesn't come naturally to this president. I heard what Mayor Vasquez had to say earlier today, and if I were him, I would be very concerned on the timing of the Fort Benning assault force.
With all due deference to you, Wendy, I'm going to have to agree with my colleague from the London Examiner. These kinds of decisions have a way of paralyzing this president. And asking to take a huge military risk is like asking a bird to build a roof on its nest. I completely agree with Simon's analysis of the situation in Miami. If a decisive military action does take place, it will be because someone else, someone like Joint Chiefs Chairman Ibibio, forced it to happen, not because the president suddenly got on his front foot militarily.
We obviously don't know who his challenger will be, but I'd like to hear each of your thoughts on his viability in next year's election.
Well, he's had a tough year, no question about it, but a lot can happen between now and the election. If the election were held today, he'd be in trouble. But the election isn't being held today. Don't forget, in 1983, Ronald Reagan's approval rating was 35%. In the 1984 presidential election, he won every state in the Union except Minnesota.
I'm sure President Stevenson appreciates Wendy's optimism. I think it's going to be tough for Stevenson, but let's see what happens in Miami. America does not want to see another fallen city. If he can manage this crisis to a successful outcome, I think it will provide penance for many past sins.
Godfrey, your thoughts?
Without question, the man will be voted out of office.
Well, I'd like to thank all three of you for being here. That concludes this week's program. For Radio Living America, I'm Brian Andrews, asking that you stay safe, stay alert, and stay in the fight.